The new bright and breezy Netflix movie Enola Holmes stars Millie Bobby Brown as the 16-year-old sister of Sherlock Holmes. She sets out on an adventure when her eccentric mother goes missing. Said eccentric mother is played, it will not shock you to learn, by Helena Bonham Carter. It also features Sam Claflin as her stuffy brother Mycroft, and just deeply, deeply weirdly, it has to be said, Henry Cavill as Sherlock. I'm Glenn Weldon. We're talking about Enola Holmes on this episode of Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. Joining us from his home in Washington, D.C. is writer Chris Klimek. Hey, Chris.
Hey, the game's afoot, Glenn.
Certainly is. Also with us from our home in Brooklyn is Daisy Rosario, an executive producer at Stitcher with the new show All-American Tiger Woods, which is out now. Hey, Daisy.
Hello, Glenn.
And with us from her home in Boston is Margaret Willison, who is one half of the Two Bossy Dames newsletter and one third of the Appointment Television podcast. Welcome back, Margaret H.
There's my middle initial. I was waiting for it, Glenn.
Now, this movie is based on a series of YA mysteries by Nancy Springer, and I think it's safe to say it plants a lot of seeds that seem destined to germinate if this thing gets a sequel or two or five. Millie Bobby Brown, who played 11 on Stranger Things, is not just the star here. She's also a producer of the movie, which makes a lot of sense to me, given how, I would say, uncannily suited she seems to this role. The bones of the plot: her mother goes missing, so Enola's older brothers threaten to send her to a ladies' finishing school. And there is such a satisfying inevitability to the casting of this film. I mean, if I were to tell you that the headmistress of the ladies' finishing school is played by Fiona Shaw, you'd say to me, you know, somehow I've always known that. So Enola goes off in search of her mother, getting wrapped up with a young Marquess played by Louis Partridge, who looks like if Victorian England had boy bands. And his life is being threatened by mysterious forces. And once again, if I were to tell you Bern Gorman shows up as a murderous thug, you'd be like, duh, water is wet.
I'd be like, duh, that guy's not Willem Dafoe. Are you sure?
Exactly. They have some facial.
I struggled with that too, Chris.
All right, Daisy, I'm going to start with you. What'd you think?
Well, I had so many thoughts because my opinion is all over the place on this movie. Because this movie is all over the place. So let's just say I was all in at the idea. I am absolutely one of those adult women who is just YA mysteries. Catnip for me. Like, I was like, yes, bring it. Like, it started and I was like, talk to me, Millie Bobby Brown, talk to me. And then I was like, what is happening? Why is this going off the rails? And it just started to feel like, can something have too much budget? I think so. There was just so much going on. And I wanted to love it. And look, ultimately at the end of the day, what I do want to say is, there are movies I loved when I was a young woman because I was happy to get to see a young woman. And in retrospect, they weren't great. And I hope there are plenty of young people who like love this in some deep way that when they revisit it at 30, will be like, oh my God, what is happening to the structure of this thing? But it is a hot mess. And let's get into it, y'all. It is so weird. I love it. And I hate it at the same time. I shouted alone. It was Mystery Science Theater alone in my apartment. It was insane.
Okay. Well, I like when we have a variety of takes. It's rare that we get a variety of takes in one person, but I'm here for it.
Yes. It's great to hear from the panel. Thank you, Daisy.
It's so many things.
All right, Margaret H., you're up. What'd you think?
I think I'm very aligned with Daisy on this. What I'd say is that if you are determined to like this movie, you'll find reason to. The casting alone, other than, as you say, Glenn, the weirdness of who they picked for Sherlock Holmes, is excellent. The movie itself, if you go in wanting it to be great, you'll be disappointed.
Yeah.
I'm a, you know, avid lifelong mystery consumer, YA and otherwise. And what I would say the problem with this is, you're never given enough sense of the stakes in any of the mysteries that she's solving to be able to orient yourself in her progress towards goals solving them. It's just sort of like unconnected circumstances springing around. And then when it finally is resolved, you're like, oh, so it was that one unnecessary biographical detail revealed the very first time we met this character. That's all we needed to solve this problem. And I would love for there to be more of this because, like Daisy, I couldn't be more open to the idea of this series. But they just need to bring me and Daisy on as consultants. I mean, I think that's it. We could get this where it needs to go.
Clearly, yeah.
We have found, as John Hodgman would say, the crux, I think, right there. Okay. All right, Chris, where are you going to stand? Are you going to be somewhere in the middle? Because, there's no middle here.
It's a boring place to be, right in the middle, like Jean-Claude Van Damme doing the splits between those two semi-trucks.
Okay. It's a topical reference.
Okay, so everybody is picking on Henry Cavill as Sherlock Holmes, right? And I think we need to back up and just acknowledge that it is admirable that this guy has not let his diminutive stature and reptilian appearance stop him from achieving his dreams in Hollywood. That is noteworthy, and I admire it. I don't know if there's a casting problem, but I think there is a characterization problem. I mean, this is the warm, sympathetic Sherlock Holmes. Interestingly enough, this is why this film is the subject to a copyright claim.
Yeah.
Because it is this late pivot of Sherlock Holmes into empathy and humanity in the final stories that are not yet in the public domain. I probably would have liked this movie a little better if Sherlock Holmes was more of a jerk. Cavill was a very good jerk in Mission Impossible Fallout. And beyond that, there is some real narrative opacity here. You know, Chinatown is one of my favorite movies. I got no problem with a convoluted plot. But for a movie adapted from a YA novel, I had a lot of trouble following this, you know, and there were elements of it that I wanted to lean into more. The idea that there is a suffragette plot here that I wanted more from. That's a lot more interesting to me than the budding romance, young House of Lords guy plot that's sort of related to that, but in a, you know, an extremely vague way. It's weird when a movie that I think this is just a hair over 2 hours long, but it feels like there are scenes missing.
I mean,
it's blurry.
And it also felt so long.
Yeah.
long.
It is, I would say, about 15 minutes too long. And every one of those 15 minutes is occupied by the sort of Marquess romantic subplot, which goes nowhere. But I got to tell you guys, I am not remotely a YA person, but I was utterly charmed by this thing. This thing charmed the pants off me, and I was in from the jump. We see her cycling down a country lane and unsteadily on her cycle, and that becomes a plot point. That becomes something that's important later. And the music's bum, 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 bum. And we zoom in as she is cycling, and she turns to the camera and whips her hair and says, "Where to begin?" And we get the music soars, and we get that drone shot of the rolling green English countryside. And I was like, I am here. I am in. I want to live in this place.
Yes.
Yes, the plot's too much and it's all over the place. But I was so charmed by not just the performance of Millie Bobby Brown, but by her presence. She is so keyed in to this role, I think, that like even, I mean, this movie breaks the fourth wall repeatedly. Arguably too much, but I found myself looking forward to it every time. She is so good and commanding and charming. And, you know, Fleabag aside, that technique is deadly. Right. Mm-hmm. If you do that even once, you are playing with the reality that you're trying to create and you run the risk of destroying it. But I don't know. There's just something so charming about her. OK, so Henry Cavill, I did not understand this, what some would call a radical reinterpretation. I would say a weird misinterpretation of who Sherlock Holmes is. He is so warm and empathetic and downright tender that leave aside the whole thing about the lawsuit and how in the later books he gets a soul, it does not comport with any understanding of who Sherlock Holmes is. I agree with you. If he had been a jerk, if they hadn't shunted all the jerky tendencies off to Mycroft, which they do here, I think I would have liked it more. Another thing, who cares about like Sherlock Holmes, you know, canonical physicality, but like, he didn't bulge out of his tweed frock coat. That's one thing he didn't do. He also could put his arms down at his sides, which Henry Cavill cannot do. He can reach into his pocket, for one, which this guy can't do.
I'd say that it is frustrating for a film that frames itself as being about female empowerment to, in terms of the structure of its plot, be so skint on like real moments of adventure and development for Enola Holmes. It seems like most of the energy goes into putting her in a variety of different gorgeous costumes, which admittedly are gorgeous, and this very tepid romance plot with the dumb Marquis. And she does interact with these suffragettes. I would have loved to see her become a part of that suffragette group. I would have loved to see the character energy put into the Marquis redirected towards connecting her to this network of women in London. Because I just feel like there's so much more interesting narrative potential there than there is with the Marquis. A love story this slight can be established in like a scene. If you've seen Monsoon Wedding,
yeah,
like at the very end of that movie, you get one across the eye glance between the sort of like scrappy feminist Indian character and the like Indian guy with glasses. You're like, God, I bet they're going to end up together. And that's all you need to know that she's got, you know, something on the back burner. And that's where the love interest mm-hmm. should have been for this story. And instead, it was central and yet underdeveloped.
Yeah. I mean, there were so many times where I was like, it doesn't even feel like a movie. It feels like five episodes strung together because like the way that things are happening and the way that they change direction on things. I mean, it's both like an over-reliance and like not really committing to the talking to the camera thing, because you have these moments where she's just like, and now we're going on this part of the journey. And I'm like, nothing has been earned there. At the same time, if I make a list of like what all these things are, I love the idea of them and would have loved to see them executed really well. I like seeing that they were trying to be thoughtful about certain things. And there are some moments. There's like one moment with Henry Cavill and a minor character where this character is like questioning the way that Sherlock sees the world. And that scene really stuck out to me in terms of being a really well-crafted moment of like what this movie was trying to be in a larger sense for young women, but it was just really poorly executed in a lot of ways. But I agree, Millie Bobby Brown is so compelling, and I loved getting just to see her be more emotive, I guess, is really the mm-hmm. thing to say, because Eleven's like a very kind of straightforward character. So in that sense, it was great to see her try all of these things, but it just felt like they were trying to put, you know, three seasons worth of a show in one movie and also didn't commit to a lot of the choices individually. So it was a bummer in that sense, but I love what they're going for.
You know, I wish there was something more to hang this on emotionally than I have to find my mom, because this premise kind of falls apart when you look at it for even a second, where, you know, mom is going off on this secret mission that she has to keep her daughter in the dark about to protect her. But then she also leaves these elaborate clues with the, you know, intention that her daughter will decode them and follow her. Like, that doesn't make any sense.
So this is a very, I would say, kind of a sudsier, frothier, lighter version of Victorian England than we are used to seeing in fiction and literature.
There's an absence of threat.
You talked about the stakes, and I agree with you, the stakes are all over the map. Did that undercut the stakes for you, just the way that this is so, I mean, this is unfair to say, but it's kind of a YA vision of Victorian England, no?
It is unfair to say, because there are plenty of adult novels that are only interested in historical settings for the frippery and not for the grit, mm-hmm. right? Uh-huh. Lots of adult fiction also just wants to put it on like a costume. So let's right. not just step to YA here. That said, stylistically, I have less of an issue with it, but I have more of an issue with it in terms of societal pressure, right? Because the crux of this story is there are people within London who are not represented and not understood, who are sort of pushing at this point in Victorian London for greater representation in the government and greater voting rights. And that's a really powerful story. And what would make that story vastly more powerful if you illustrated, like, how incredibly dangerous it would be for Millie Bobby Brown's character to go alone around London dressed in like a stunning silk frock and not have a lady's maid companion. And that's very much the kind of thing that character would have to learn, because she's been sheltered in her manor house with her feminist mother for her whole life. She would have no idea what the expectations of general female comportment could be. And adding that would create stakes both for the main mystery they're looking to solve and for the characters. So get rid of as much of the coal dust as you'd like to, but please leave the oppression.
I would have loved more deductive reasoning here as opposed to mm-hmm. just the business yes. with the anagrams, but man, yeah. I had such a great time with this and y'all didn't. And that's what makes the world go round. So tell us what you think about Enola Holmes. I'm very curious if I'm alone on this ice floe. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or tweet us at PCHH. When we come back, it will be time to talk about what's making us happy this week. So come right back.
Activist Aaron Dorr tells his flock of pro-gun followers on Facebook that he's tirelessly fighting for their Second Amendment rights. But if that's true, why do so many pro-gun Republicans hate him so much?
Aaron Dorr is a scam artist, a liar, and he is doing Iowans no services and no favors.
Find out on the No Compromise podcast from NPR.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. It's time for our favorite segment of this week and every week. What's making us happy this week? Daisy Rosario, what's making you happy this week?
Well, what is making me happy here in New York is the feeling of autumn rolling in and how that is inspiring me to just dive right in to all of the autumn horror movies that I want to watch. I'm not waiting. I don't care. Some people have pumpkin spice. I have this. And so it's already started. Nightmare on Elm Street 1 and 2 were watched on Sunday. And now I'm fully ready to dive into kind of revisiting a lot of 80s slasher. So going to do Friday 13th from the beginning. I can't wait. Pumpkin cheesecake has been eaten. It is time. And I am like ready for more. And I'm counting down the days until when I can watch Linus and the Great Pumpkin. I mean, it's Charlie Brown, but it's all about Linus. You know what I mean?
Sure it is. Absolutely it is.
That has to happen closer to Halloween, but that's what's making me happy is the sweet, sweet, crisp autumn and all of the kind of fall movie, TV shows, and specifically horror movies that I get to dive into. Old horror movies that I love and feel safe watching.
All right, Daisy, text me when you get to the one where Jason goes to space. Margaret H. Willison, what's making you happy this week?
So I'm a deeply extroverted person and I love making small talk with strangers, which means the pandemic has been horrible because I can't make small talk with strangers anywhere. I don't get to meet strangers. So a way that I have been getting a little bit of my talk to strangers energy out there that's been giving me a huge amount of joy since like April is on my Instagram profile on Sundays, I've been running music polls where I put out prompts like, tell me a song that you nursed a crush to and like tell me about the crush. And people submit songs that they, you know, at 11 listen to over and over and over again in their bedroom while thinking about their math tutor or whatever. Actually, a good one there is a girl listened to Blackbird by the Beatles over and over again while having a crush on her camp counselor, which is just like, what a perfect pairing of song and crush. And I put together a little story on my Instagram highlighting some of the answers, and then I compile everything into a big Spotify playlist. And it's been an incredible music discovery tool for me, a great way of interacting with strangers. And I think this Sunday, I'm going to be doing a playlist to help out somebody in the Pop Culture Happy Hour family. So if this sounds like fun to you and you want to come and make small talk with me about music, you can find me on Instagram at Mrs. Friday Next. I'm pretty sure my Spotify handle is also Mrs. Friday Next. You can check out the playlist that already exists. I think there are like 11 or 12 at this point. And just come talk to me. Come be strangers who are nice who talk to me. Thank you.
I love it. I can't wait.
Yeah. You know, I'm reminded of the Homer Simpson quote, you know, Marge, in many ways, you and I are very different people. Chris Klimek, what's making you happy this week?
Glenn, what's making me happy this week is The Massacre of Mankind. That is, in fact, the title of a 2017 novel by Stephen Baxter. I know it should be The Massacre of Humankind. The reason it's not is because that's a quote from H.G. Wells, and The Massacre of Mankind is the authorized sequel to The War of the Worlds. Mm-hmm. Good pair for Sherlock Holmes because Wells is in the public domain now, or most of it, so the authorized part is of little import. But this is a book set in 1920, 13 years after the initial failed Martian invasion of Earth. We're in England, which has been transformed into an almost fascistic, militaristic state because they're all about prepping for the next Martian invasion. The entire purpose of humanity is to get ready to repel the next wave. Our narrator is Julia Elphinstone, who is a journalist. She is the ex-sister-in-law of the unnamed person who wrote the original War of the Worlds, which is in canon, like a, you know, a nonfiction chronicle of the first Martian invasion. As much of a potboiler and just like a cool action-packed sci-fi story as this is, it's also sort of a clever literary thing where there are all these allusions to other Wells works and to other adaptations of War of the Worlds, including the 1938 Orson Welles ones and the 1950s movie. Those references are there for you if you pick up on them, but they don't get in the way if you haven't read all your Wells or haven't seen all those things. They do, you know, function exactly as references should, where they're not slowing anything down. So the book is The Massacre of Mankind by Stephen Baxter. Really, really dug it.
That's great. I'm hoping the second wave of aliens brought some antibiotics because that seems to be the secret. All right. What's making me happy this week is, you know, when we talked earlier about how fresh and clean and weirdly wholesome Enola Holmes' version of Victorian London seems, if you need something to kind of cut that sweetness a bit, Year of the Rabbit is a British comedy series airing on IFC here in the States. It stars the brilliant, the very funny Matt Berry of Toast of London and What We Do in the Shadows. And he's playing a very, it has to be said, a very Matt Berry-like detective on the streets of London in the 1880s. You're looking at just 6 half-hour episodes. There is another season on the way. It is a very silly and filthy and profane show, and is also, fair warning, a bit gory. And it also features the great Susan Wacoma, who had a small part in Enola Holmes, and she gets a hell of a lot more to do here. That is Year of the Rabbit on IFC. And that brings us to the end of our show. You can find all of us on Twitter. You can find me at G.H. Weldon. You can follow Chris at C.T. Clement. You can follow Margaret at Mrs. Friday Next. You can follow Daisy at RunDMR. You can follow our producer, Jessica Reedy, at Jessica_Reedy, and producer Mike Katziff at Mike Katziff, that's K-A-T-Z-I-F. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides the music you may or may not be bobbing your head to right now. You're an adult, make your own life choices. Thanks to all of you for being here.
Thanks, Glenn.
Thanks for having me, Glenn.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. And if you have a second and you're so inclined, please subscribe to our newsletter at npr.org/popculturenewsletter, and we will see you all next week.